about. You know, I had some
computers. I just need to go in there. Everything raised.
I found it when I got home. I
follow up on my tape recording machine.
I thought the important thing was to tell the people's expectations.
I don't think they were not able to listen to the tape. So I know
they're tracking. In fact, the job training
coming with an open mind.
Right now,
as open as it has always been, full of holes,
like a stiff.
What a rare place.
It's a new view again. Yeah, I don't have a choice in it, but I got to
that's fine. You got home of the two boats.
Oh, I put the vice chair in that. That's a good chair.
That was a bad influence on
him. No, no, I'm sitting next to him anymore. No, no, I saw him.
Well,
the temporary chair had a very difficult time Friday when you left.
I understand there was something of movement at the committee.
Just complain about it now.
Someone will do a walkout.
Yes.
What?
He said,
he handled it very well.
Maybe he's more moderate.
Move faster than.
I'll take it.
Are we going to be able to go to our office at 4 o'clock? Get that vote. They did write on that agenda.
I have a couple of drafting requests that I'd like to review with the committee. The first is from Representative Mary Alice Ford. It's a request on behalf of the Governor's Task Force on Drunk Driving. And I believe it is the last measure out of that task force, which apparently did not get finished. It relates to the imposition of an excise tax at the wholesale level on beer, wine, and distilled spirits to be dedicated for the purpose of a DUII countermeasures account to be appropriated for the purpose of DUII prevention, education, and enforcement. There will be a board appointed by the governor to deal with the programs under that account. Anyway, it is a proposal from that task force and will be introduced at their request. Chair would move the approval of the drafting request for the governor's task force. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
I object.
Any others? The second drafting request is really two that I think appropriately should be combined into a single vehicle. The first was submitted to me from Representative Rutherford. It is a letter from Robert C. Shoemaker in Portland. And the measure relates to the withholding or withdrawal of life sustaining procedures for a person suffering from terminal illness who are comatose with no reasonable possibility of returning to a cognitive state. And the legislation itself,
I think you have reviewed. I don't take your submission of this to me as an endorsement of the bill, but a...
No, I think it needs to go to the legislative council.
The second and somewhat related issue was presented by Representative Miller, who notes that ORS Chapter 97 outlines a procedure by which a terminally ill individual may instruct his or her physician not to prolong the individual's life by artificial means. The present statute requires those instructions be renewed every 5 years. The requested legislation would eliminate that requirement.
And it would also allow a person who is not diagnosed as terminally ill to execute similar instructions.
I'm sure if these are presented separately, they will probably be, the Speaker's approval, they'll probably be requested they be combined. There's two different measures. So we can address that larger area at the same time. So the Chair would move that these two measures be presented as a drafting request for a single bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Smith.
Have we, on all these, do we have the approval of the Speaker already?
No, I'm proposing...
This is just a drafting request.
Drafting request, not an introduction request.
But the previous motion was a motion for introduction.
No, it was drafting also.
Oh, I apologize, I misunderstood that. I thought that was for introduction.
Do you wish me to record it differently as to that?
I'll let that stand. I thought...
No, it was a drafting request also.
All right.
Is there any discussion of the motion? Is there any objection? Okay, we'll begin now our work session as a full committee. First four bills are the Commission on Judicial Branch Dispute Resolution Package, the substantial elements of it, the first of which is House Bill 2361. Kirk?
This bill had hearing on January 25th and a work session on February 17th, at which some additional testimony was taken. The bill would allow establishment of a mandatory arbitration program in the counties upon a vote of the judges of the counties and subject to approval by the Chief Justice as to the form of the plan. And if a program is adopted, the arbitration will be mandatory for actions involving claims under $15,000 and involving only money claims. The parties would be required to go to arbitration, but afterwards, if a party was dissatisfied with the award, that party can request trial de novo within 20 days after the arbitration award. The only penalty is that the party has to post a $150 bond, which will be forfeited if the party doesn't improve his or her position at trial de novo. And I believe a party also waives any right to attorney's fees or cost of disbursement upon trial de novo if that party doesn't improve position on the retrial. There were a variety of proposals to change it. The committee ended up rejecting all those proposals and recommending that the bill be passed in its original form. Do you want me to go through any of the arguments that were considered by the committee and rejected? I've distributed most of the information already to the other committee members.
I don't believe that will be necessary unless there are specific questions along that line from committee members. I take it then there are no amendments forwarded from the subcommittee to the bill that's introduced.
That's correct.
Representative Courtney?
I move the bill to the floor, House Bill 2361, with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Courtney moves that House Bill 2361 be reported with a two-pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call roll.
Representative
Hill. Aye. Lombard. Aye. North.
Aye.
Scavero.
Aye.
Courtney.
Yes.
Aye.
Springer.
No.
Rutherford.
Aye.
Carolyn Myers.
Aye.
Approved. We'll assign floor managers for the, assuming relatively large group of bills out of committee. Probably tomorrow I'll have a chance to confer with Vice Chair of the Subcommittee with two bills. House Bill 2362. Mr. Bell.
This is somewhat more complicated. This bill also came from the Commission on the Judicial Branch. Again, it allows the judges in the Circuit Court of the County to establish a mandatory mediation program whenever any domestic relations suit involves either child custody or child visitation rights. The mediation is intended only to cover those two areas and not any other area of the domestic relations dispute. Once a county indicates it wants such a program, it is subject to the Chief Justice's approval. The program as I mentioned, would provide for mandatory mediation as soon as it appears on the face of the pleadings that child visitation or child custody is an issue. The parties would automatically be put in a mediation program while the rest of their case went through the circuit court. There would be professional mediators provided under the county program, but the parties would have the right to employ and pay for their own private mediator, which is envisioned to include such people as the party's clergyman or some other person. The mediators hired by the county have to meet the same minimum educational requirements as conciliators now have to meet under the county conciliation programs, which are also established in the Oregon revised statutes. All mediation proceedings will be in private, and all communications made during the proceedings are privileged and can't be used in any subsequent litigation. The bill also authorizes the application of a part of the fees, which are presently collected for marriage licenses and divorce filings, to go toward paying the cost of the mediation program. Subcommittee 2 amended the bill in a number of ways, and I believe all the members have been distributed a Hannah Gross copy of the bill showing those changes. You probably would have received it either Friday afternoon or this morning, but there are not that many changes, so I can tell you what they are. In Section 2 of the bill, at lines 7 and 8, the subcommittee voted to delete the words as defined in ORS 107.510. 107.510 defines a domestic relations suit as one for the dissolution of a marriage. And testimony from Judge Nachtigall and others pointed out that quite often child custody and visitation is an issue even among people who've never been married, so that the mediation program should be broader and should apply to those disputes as well. And for that reason, the limiting definition referring to marriage dissolutions was removed. The committee later decided to amend the bill at that point in a fashion to indicate that the proceedings under the Abuse Prevention Act, which is at ORS 107.700 to 107.720, proceedings under that act would not initiate mediation. Now, this was an amendment that the committee left to me to work out with some of the interested parties, and I think it's one the committee should give a little consideration to see if it approves of the wording that we settled on. The proposed amendment was to include the words not including proceedings under ORS 107.700 to 107.720 at the end of line 7, so that in order to clarify that if someone, well, I'll explain what the Abuse Prevention Act does. That is a separate proceeding by which a battered spouse or threatened spouse can get a temporary injunction against the threatening spouse. The injunction can include an order to stay away from the house, to leave the spouse alone, whatever. It can also include a temporary order of child custody, which, as I understand it, can't extend beyond a year. That is, all occurs under those parts of ORS through separate pleadings, and is not a precursor or does not slide into a divorce suit. If you want a divorce suit, as I understand it, you have to go and file separate pleadings for that under other parts of ORS. So this, it's my belief that this amendment would simply exempt people who go in for short-term relief under the Abuse Prevention Act from having to go immediately into mediation. I think there was testimony that it would be inappropriate in those situations to automatically make people go to mediation, and that it would be better to wait until they filed for a dissolution of a marriage or for a permanent custody order. That's the purpose of that amendment. You want me to go through all the other amendments?
Are there any questions as to that amendment?
Yeah, go ahead. There was also an amendment by the subcommittee to take out the word spouses wherever it appeared in the bill and put in the word parties instead, since sometimes people who will be subject to mediation will not be spouses. I found references to spouses only at two places, on page 2 at line 16 and line 18, and so I would propose amending the word spouses at line 16 to read parties and spouse at line 18 to read party. Then the committee also heard considerable testimony about who should be allowed in the mediation proceedings and who should not be allowed in. The general tenor of most of the testimony was that only the parties and the mediator should be allowed in, and that if more people are allowed in, it will destroy the purpose of mediation, which is to have the parties themselves come up with an agreement about the proper way to do child custody and visitation. However, it was pointed out by the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence that in some cases a spouse who's been subject to domestic violence is not psychologically able to go into a mediation session against the former spouse who's perhaps battered them or intimidated them, and a mediator. The mediator's role is really to be one of finding a solution between the spouses. It's not an arbitrator or someone who's supposed to actively put forward a proposal. It's simply someone who's supposed to help the parties reach a proposal. The feeling was that sometimes battered spouses are not in a position to be able to go into mediation without having someone there with them to back them up to some degree. There was also testimony that in Multnomah County, where counsel is allowed in with the parties, counsel almost never shows up, and for that reason it was thought that it would be not too much of a problem to allow counsel in, at least under the law, since they weren't expected to come. There was also some concern by the committee members that there might be the case where a party could come out of mediation, having given away the whole ranch in exceptional cases, and so that there might be cases where the counsel really did want to be present, and it would be in the best interest of the party. I think that was all the discussion of why counsel perhaps should be left in there, and so for that reason the subcommittee decided to leave counsel in the bill, not remove counsel from the list of people who could be allowed at the mediation proceedings. There's also some testimony and some consideration about whether the children whose fate is being decided in this mediation process, whether there might be cases where it would be appropriate for the children to be present, to speak with the mediator or whatever. So children of the parties was added to the list of people who could be present at the proceedings. Witnesses was eliminated because the committee couldn't think of any case in which witnesses would be necessarily appropriate in a mediation setting, since mediation is intended simply to be an agreement between the father and the mother of the child. So this section 5, as it ended up, would read as follows: that all mediation proceedings under sections 2 to 5 of this 1983 Act shall be held in private, and all persons other than mediation service personnel, the parties, their counsel, and children of the parties shall be excluded.
Did the commission's representatives have any explanation of what was intended or what produced witnesses as being included in the bill as the commission drafted it?
I don't believe so, and I know John White said that he wasn't sure either. So there was no one here who really was a proponent of leading that in.
Any questions as to that amendment in section 5, page 2?
And the last amendment, I should mention one. The committee voted a conceptual amendment on page 1 at the bottom, lines 22 to 26. There was some concern that as the language read now, the mediator's report would necessarily have to be incorporated in the final order that the court signed. And the concern was, what about those cases where two parties go to mediation, they come out with a proposal which one or both parties' counsel then looks at and says, this will never work, we've got to change it. The committee wanted to preserve the right of counsel for the parties to perhaps object or make suggestive changes to the court after the report came out from the mediator, particularly in those cases where counsel had not gone through the mediation process. So the conceptual amendment that was voted was some sort of amendment to make it clear that the mediator's report and proposal didn't necessarily have to go in the final order of the court, but the court would be free to modify it if it saw fit. After meeting that day and discussions with John White, who's representing the Commission on Judicial Branch, we decided that the language, as it's presently written, probably is sufficient. Right now it reads, the mediator shall report in writing to counsel for the parties any agreement reached by the parties as a result of the mediation, and the agreement shall be incorporated in a proposed order or decree provision prepared for the court. And we decided the fact that it is only incorporated in a proposed order would, I think, leave the court the chance, the opportunity to modify it later, since proposed orders, it's my understanding, proposed orders are never binding on the court. They're subject to the court's approval. If the committee thinks it's a problem, we could easily modify it to make it clear that the counsel can object and the court can modify the proposed order.
Well, I think if the history of the measure is developed here in the committee is clear, it probably wouldn't be necessary to go into language further than what is in the bill. As I understand it, as it comes to us from the subcommittee, that language is intended to empower the actions by the court and the counsel that you just described.
That was my understanding, yes.
And if there's no, I guess, motion to the contrary, as far as some language eliminating that possibility, the measure's effect on Section 3, Sub 2, as reported by the committee, would be intended to be interpreted in that fashion in its application.
The last...
Do you have a question on that? Did you want to leave? You want to go first, or should we finish? Go ahead.
The last amendment also was suggested by the Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. It adds a Section 8 at the end of the bill that would read, "Nothing in this act shall preclude a party from obtaining any orders available under ORS 107.700 to 107.720 before or during mediation." Those ORS references, again, are to the Abuse Prevention Act. There was testimony that in Multnomah County, there is some reluctance on the part of the judges to give relief under the Abuse Prevention Act where the parties are in mediation. This would be the situation perhaps where the parties had filed for a divorce, then a problem of domestic violence arose and one spouse wanted to get a protective order under the Abuse Prevention Act. And the testimony was that some judges have indicated reluctance to give any protective orders under that act because the parties are in mediation. This Section 8 was added simply to indicate that the Abuse Prevention Act exists on its own and is not hindered in any way by the fact that the parties have engaged in mediation.
The Chair would move the adoption of the amendments to House Bill 2363 as reflected on the engrossed copy of the bill distributed to the committee. Well, were they all specifically some were conception? There was some conception.
One was conception.
Yeah, that's why I made that motion. Otherwise, I wouldn't be normally expected. Is there any discussion of the amendments? Is there any objection to them? We're adopted. Further discussion of the bill as amended? Yes. There's any question?
I move House Bill 2362 as amended. The House Bill to be passed recommendation.
So the 40 moves that House Bill 2362 as amended be reported with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Further discussion. The economic logistics of this, the circuit court judges, state employees by a majority vote, decide if in the district, decide if there shall be this program. If there shall be the program, then the court clerk shall collect a fee of $75 in each filed domestic relations suit. This money goes to the county. The county provides the mediation service, and I assume the county would keep any difference that would accrue. This is evidently part of the language of conciliation service. There's a $75 fee collected for domestic relations suit. What I see is that, well, not necessarily a problem, but potential issue is that there'll be domestic relations suits without children involved. There'll be domestic relations suits in which there is no need for mediation service. The parties decide who shall have custody of the case. And if it's only going to be one case in 10, let's say, that goes to mediation, then the county is going to be collecting $750 per mediated suit. And I think that may well be a real, if that's the situation, that's going to be a real moneymaker for the counties. I don't think it was the program was intended to be that. When the $75 fee was, as I understand it, when the $75 fee was set, was some years ago, but it was when each case would have conciliation. And each domestic relations suit was a potential for conciliation, but each domestic relations suit was not a potential for mediation. And I wonder if we're going to discourage the judges in the county from instituting this program, or we're going to encourage the counties to institute this program as being a potential positive cash flow program. That being said, I don't have a specific program other than, a specific amendment other than just something to the effect that we allow them to collect the fee necessary to fund the program or something, rather than set it as an exact dollar amount.
Mr. Chair, could I add one thing to that? And I noted this. This is in a memo I sent to the committee. It's related to what Representative Scavero was just saying. Under Section 6 of the Act, Section 6 of the Act amends current law, ORS 21.1112, which, as Representative Scavero said, authorizes the counties to collect a fee of $75 or an amount exceeding $75 to fund a conciliation program if they have a conciliation program in the county. That fee is only collected on domestic relations suits as defined by 107.510, which, as I mentioned earlier, is marriage dissolutions. This bill amends that section to also allow the county to apply all or part of that $75 or however much they collect to mediation services. The way this bill is written now, if a county establishes mediation services, it would be funded only by this fee collected in marriage dissolution cases and would not necessarily be funded by an unmarried couple that came in and initiated some proceedings on a child custody or visitation dispute. So it is, unfortunately, an unmarried couple that it appeared to be getting a free ride in the mediation services, at least under this section, although Section 6 does not make it mandatory for a county to collect charges through that portion of the law, through the filing fees. I suppose a county could do it in another way, I don't know. But I did mean to point that out, that this Section 6 as written would probably fund mediation only through the filing fees for a marriage dissolution case. And relating to what Representative Scavera says, it appears that under present law, the counties do collect a minimum of $75 when they have a conciliation service. This would not necessarily mean an additional $75 for if they add mediation to it. It could be whatever amount they set. I'm not sure that an amendment is needed, but that is perhaps a shortcoming in that portion of the bill.
Well, it says that county is providing conciliation or mediation services or both. You collect the fee, one fee. So if the issue is, would you be collecting two fees? It would seem to me the bill's clear on that. You would not.
Representative Rutherford Longworth speak on this one. That this, if they had conciliation, they wouldn't necessarily have to have mediation and vice versa. Is that an issue we spoke?
Well, we addressed it in the subcommittee, yeah. And I think the resolution was that we did not want to mandatorily tie one up with the other.
Yeah.
And I think we've made that clear.
I was thinking my county where they don't have conciliation services now and they might want mediation services.
In your county would be authorized to establish,
well, in fact, either.
Either or.
Or, yes.
Clerk shall collect the fee of $75 or such larger amount as the county governing body finds to be necessary.
What I'm wondering, what I'm throwing out for discussion, is would there be a need for a different fee schedule for mediation services than for conciliation services, the mediation services being a less frequent factor in dissolutions in general. Could be a conciliation services used in each dissolution, mediation used in only 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10 dissolutions.
Subcommittee addressed the cost picture.
We didn't talk about it.
If this section of line 26 through 34 addressed only mediation, then there's let's see, something on line 29. In addition to all shall collect addition to all other fees collected, start scratching everything out after that, an amount determined by the governing board of the county to be necessary to pay the expenses of providing mediation services.
Mr. Chairman, the current conciliation laws, it's not mandatory conciliation, it's only if one party requests it, petitions for conciliation, so I would think that even under the current conciliation services, there are, I don't know how many, but many, many dissolution cases do not go through conciliation, but they're still charged a $75 fee. And I would think it'd be, in fact, there was testimony that mediation would involve most, if not all, most domestic relations cases will involve a child custody or child visitation issue, or very many of them will, and mediation will be mandatory for them. So it might, I would be surprised if $75 would be too much of a fee to charge, even though some couples don't use it. It would be very similar to the current situation with conciliation.
If they don't have children, they probably wouldn't have mediation. But any childless couples. I don't have a specific motion to resolve what I perceive as a potential problem. I think we might discourage this program in certain counties, and we also might be encouraged in that.
I'm not sure.
Propose, if it's all right with the committee, to introduce it as part of the legislative record.
Is a question appropriate, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Smith, would this legislation prevent parties to a contract from agreeing on a different definition of prevailing party or specifying prevailing party, or would it leave discretion only in the court? Certain people that I've represented now are growing very, very cautious about how they draft these things, and they're putting in actual attorney's fees instead of reasonable. They're doing a number of things in their contracts, and it seems to me they're trying to reach a specific conclusion. Would that contract force the Supreme Court to exercise its discretion in favor of the clear intent of the contract?
This bill makes a very narrow amendment to the attorney's fees on appeal statute. So let me look quickly at the rest of the statute. This bill would not really, as I see it, would not really affect that issue at all. It simply allows the court, essentially allows the court to get around what is presently a curious and probably wrong straitjacket as to who can be the prevailing party on an appeal. So let me look at the statute just a moment. Well, I would say, just looking at the bill, which reprints ORS 20.096 sub 1, as it's written now, it says, in any action or suit on a contract where such contract specifically provides that attorney's fees and costs shall be awarded, the prevailing party shall be entitled to reasonable attorney's fees. You could read that right now as not necessarily allowing the parties to supersede that by contract. That issue is not really
raised. It's a separate issue, apparently, but I guess it's one I'd feel better if it were clarified, because more often now we are drawing documents for people that say prevailing party shall receive actual attorney's fees, and that simply means we will present affidavits and so forth to justify actuality.
I do believe I asked Mr. Winslow at the hearing whether the intent of the parties would prevail, if you could get an intent as to who was the prevailing party, and I believe his answer was yes, that just generally the intent of the parties under their contract would prevail over the provisions of law.
Well, I think, Representative Smith, unless there is a contrary expression on the part of the subcommittee, that we would, as part of our legislative history, intend, make the statement that we would intend that the amendments to this bill would not affect the force of contractual provisions dealing with attorney's fees.
Well,
take it, if there's no other expression of view on that, that is the intention of the committee. Further discussion? Is there a motion on the bill?
So moved.
Representative Courtney moves that House Bill 2306, there were no amendments, which you described. You were just going to explain it to our member,
yes.
Interpreted that. That House Bill 2306 be reported for the due pass recommendation. So further discussion? Hold on.
Representative Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lomberg?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Myers?
Aye. Approved. House Bill 2310.
This bill was also presented by the Oregon State Bar, the corporate business and corporate law section. I believe it was one session ago when the Oregon Rules of Evidence were first promulgated. Toward the end of the session, an amendment was made in the definition of a corporate client, I believe, representative of a client. Essentially, this bill gets at the extent of the attorney-client privilege where the client is a corporation. It gets at that by the definition of who the representative of the client is, because it is the attorney-client privilege under this rule, I believe, only extends to the attorney and communications with the representative of the client. The Oregon Evidence Code, as it was enacted in the last session, contained a very, very narrow definition of who within the corporation could talk to the attorney of the corporation without having their communication subject to discovery by an opposing party. It basically limited the attorney's right to talk to someone within the corporation to only persons who have authority to obtain professional legal services for the corporation and to act on advice rendered pursuant thereto. In other words, it was the narrow, there's been a great national debate about the extent of attorney-client privilege for a corporate client. The Oregon Evidence Code is last enacted, adopted the most restrictive rule, which essentially meant that a corporation's attorney could not talk to lower employees in the corporation unless that they had the independent power to hire counsel for the corporation, which almost no employees have. If an attorney spoke to these lesser employees in the corporation to try to gather facts about what happened in a particular lawsuit, those communications were discoverable in a subsequent deposition of that particular employee. The business and corporate law section of the bar redefined representative of the client to parallel the test that was stated in the Upjohn case. The Upjohn case is a U.S. Supreme Court decision of about a year ago, which finally settled what the rule was to be under the Federal Evidence Code, and which included a broader test or range of persons with whom a corporate attorney could communicate and have the communication be privileged. It basically covers the corporate attorney under this proposed amendment would be able to talk to corporate employees, officers, or directors who either provide the corporation's lawyer with information acquired in the course of employment or the ongoing relationship with the corporation, and by means of which the corporation is trying to obtain legal services. So the new broader rule would protect conversations between an employee and a lawyer by which the lawyer is trying to get information for the lawsuit, or this new rule would also protect communications where the employee, as a part of the employee's employment, is seeking legal advice from the corporate lawyer. It would cover the cases where a corporate employee has gone to the corporate lawyer and said, how should we handle this under the antitrust laws or whatever. Those communications would also be privileged. So this bill parallels the rule set forth in the Upjohn case. At hearing, the committee voted to amend the bill in three minor ways, which are shown on the Hannah Gross copy that was sent out. It would amend the bill at line 16 to put in a 1 in parenthesis after the word client at the end of the line. a two in parenthesis after the word or at line 19, and this was simply to clarify what was otherwise a very long, long, convoluted sentence, and to add the words employment or on line 19 between the word that and ongoing. The reason for adding employment or was simply to come up with parallelism. Up in lines 17 and 18, they talk about information acquired during the course of or as a result of employment or other ongoing regular relationship. And in line 19, they come back again to as part of that employment or ongoing regular relationship. The committee asked the witness if it would be all right to make the two sections parallel, and the witness said yes, if that would be fine, that would be exactly what they wanted. So those were the three amendments that were voted on by the committee.
Those were adopted with support.
Yes.
Is your motion on the bill as amended?
So moved.
Representative Lombard moves that House Bill 2310 be as amended be reported for the due pass. Is there further discussion? Hold on.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
2532.
This bill was introduced by the Judiciary Committee. It has to do with a very narrow portion of the existing judges' retirement fund. Under the present rules of the judges' retirement fund, a judge, there's a scale of benefits provided for the surviving spouse of a deceased judge. If the scale is reduced, however, if the deceased judge and the spouse were married less than 10 years and are more than 3 years apart in age, the scale of benefits is reduced if either the judge and the spouse were married for less than 10 years, or they are not more than 3 years apart in their age, or something. It's essentially to penalize a judge who remarries someone who is more than 3 years younger than the judge is. Apparently, there was testimony that this was historical. It was meant, it was passed in response to Judge Latourette's marriage to a considerably younger woman in the early 1950s. So this bill would eliminate that part of the judge's retirement fund so that there would be no longer be any discrimination. All spouses of deceased judges would get the same range of benefits regardless of how long the judge and the spouse have been married and what their differences in their age was. And we received just at the start of the hearing a fiscal analysis statement showing no fiscal impact. The subcommittee voted a due pass to the full committee.
Does this measure a subsequent parallel?
Yes, to waive the means.
I might say that typically retirement-related legislation, even without an identified fiscal impact, has been referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
One other thing, there were some amendments that were considered in conjunction with either this bill or the judge's retirement bill. They were amendments that were suggested by Judge Helen Fry, Judge Sam Stewart of the Tax Court, and former Judge Shirley Field. And in consulting with the chairman and the vice chairman, it was decided to combine those three proposals in a separate bill, which is now an LC draft request. And those three judges know of that decision. Those three proposals would probably have a fiscal impact, unlike this proposal.
Is there a motion on the bill?
So moved.
Representative Lombard moves that House Bill 2532 be reported with a due pass recommendation. And it will be, by prior reference, referred to the committee. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, in view of the fiscal impact analysis that's been given us, out of a Senate's conduct these days, would it be appropriate to ask the floor to remove the subsequent referral since it appears there is no impact of any significant amount? And that our report would go out, first of all, to seek the removal of that subsequent referral.
I
I have no objection to that, Representative Smith. My comment earlier was simply on the basis that I don't know how Speaker Carroll's approaching this issue. I think during the time I was applying the jurisdictional rules of the House, all retirement legislation, regardless of whether it affected, had a fiscal impact, was substantially referred to the Ways and Means Committee. I don't know if that's present speaker's intentions. I have no objection. The committee wishes to report it with a recommendation to be rescinded. I could then perhaps have a meeting with him and find out if that's running contrary to his own interpretation of the rules or whether that's consistent.
Who has a motion pending right now?
I'll amend the motion.
Representative Lombard moves that, withdraws his previous motion, moves that House Bill 2532 be reported with a due pass recommendation and a further recommendation that the subsequent referrals to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Further discussion?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, to that motion.
Mr. Smith?
At least in Justice Denneke's testimony before the subcommittee was distributed February 22, and he indicated that this same position died for lack of attention, I think, in the Ways and Means Committee. If it has no impact, I think it justifies the addition of the rescission.
Well, I'm going to handle it this way. I'm going to do the same thing I would expect to be done if I were still Speaker, which is I'm going to go in and talk to Speaker Cairns about his interpretation of the rules as applied to retirement legislation. If he requests that the bill go to Ways and Means, I would hope the committee would be willing to assist in that effort in the sense that we would simply, let's see what we're going to have to do at that point.
We'd have to call the report back or re-refer
it back. Yeah. Well, let's proceed on that basis and see what happens. Further discussion of the motion. Call the roll.
Representative Corton?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Tavera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Chairman Myers?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if in the future, to avoid the kind of questions we just got into, we might be able to ask the fiscal analyst to give us a more specific estimate of the cost of retirement bills. I noticed they usually say there'll be minimal cost or there'll be slight cost or something like that, but I heard they ever say what they really think they're going to cost. I would assume that that's possible to calculate. I might be wrong.
Yes, and the urgency of that, too, will obviously depend on what attitude Speaker Cairns is taking about retirement legislation. It's his view that the rules compel all such legislation to go to Ways and Means, then I think we should still have a relatively specific statement that it will not, in that situation, bear on whether this committee seeks to rescind the subsequent referral or attach one. For example, we did get a bill without one. The major bill did not have one on it. I think that was happening. I think that was just inadvertent. 2536.
This bill is a Judiciary Committee bill sponsored by the State Court Administrator. The hearing was held before the full committee on February 21st. Basic function of the bill is to require the respondent to an appeal to designate the record on appeal in the same manner as the appellant is required to do. I believe since that hearing, I can't remember if this was raised at the full hearing or not, but we received a letter from Michael L. Williams on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Procedure and Practice supporting the bill. And there are no amendments pending.
Representative Courtney moves House Bill 2536 be reported with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Scavera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Aye. Approved. 2537.
This bill is also presented by the State Court Administrator. It's a Judiciary Committee bill. It amends a number of dates in the appeal statutes to change them from multiples of 10 days to multiples of 7 days for the purposes of easier scheduling and generally easier scheduling on the part of attorneys, too, since they can just add and compute in multiples of weeks instead of trying to figure out what 30 days is added to a particular date. There was a letter also from Michael Williams on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Procedure and Practice concerned that any change to a 7-day multiple be a rounding up instead of a rounding down, particularly the time for filing a notice of appeal. The present time is 30 days, and the letter expresses the concern that if it's reduced to 28 days, there will be quite a few attorneys who mess things up for a couple of years, and that so the recommendation is that the date be extended instead to 35 days. And I think, I haven't gone through here yet, but I think there's at least one or two other places where the time period is reduced rather than extended. I know that there is at least that one place.
Well, the matter's before us without amendment at this point. Let's get to the heart of this. I think the bill otherwise is going out. Is there a motion to amend
F-11 is the first reference.
Let's, we better take them specifically just so we're sure here. Line 11, let's see if we can just enumerate them for the record so it's clear. Line 11, what I'm asking, I'm going to ask for a motion to amend to 35 days at line 11.
And then if
there is a motion, if not, then the bill will obviously not be amended. Line 1, page 2.
I'm looking for the section I haven't spotted it yet. The effective date of the act.
It appears there is not. It would just be 90 days after the end of the century.
Do we have a motion before us on any other matter, or may I make another suggestion?
There's no motion yet.
I guess I'd like to get some discussion on the point of having a specific effective date for these changes for the very reason that we're looking at the other numbers. Sufficient time within which for the practicing members of the bar to alert themselves to the changes, and oftentimes we move those to the first of a year or some other date other than the arbitrary 90 days after cessation of the session.
We have another bill pending that will come up for hearing on Tuesday, looking at the ORCP changes promulgated by the Council on Court Procedures, and that bill presently pushes forward the effective date of those changes to January 1 of 84.
I'd like to make a motion on that, Mr. Chairman. I would move that the effective date of the changes that we adopt in this bill be January 1, 1984.
Is there further discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Adopted. Is there a motion to amend the time period in the measure at line? Page 1, line 11, and page 2, line 1.
I'd like to get the State Court Administrator's response to the letter requesting extension of time.
Betsy, I think you touched on that earlier, but I think it's appropriate to hear again. What is the concern about the upward revision?
Betsy Dalshaw, State Court Administrator. I checked with the appellate courts, and they have no objection to raising it to 35 days. Case records manager, who's here, has no objection to raising it to 35 days either.
Chair so moves. Is there any objection to the amendment? Motion on the bill is amended.
Before I do pass.
Representative Courtney Moore's House Bill 2537 be reported, as amended, be reported with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? call the roll.
Representative Sandbauer.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Hill.
Aye.
Courtney.
Yes.
Lombard.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Rutherford.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye. We'll take 2013 and then pause for a breath there. That's the one of the remaining bills that has no amendments, fairly straightforward bill. We'll pause.
Right.
House Bill 2213.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and committee members, this was sent due pass to the full committee by subcommittee one. ORS 421-180 presently requires the Corrections Division to adopt procedures to be utilized in disciplining persons committed to the Corrections Division and requires that those procedures be subject to the approval of the governor. The testimony from the Corrections Division is that they currently adopt their procedures governing discipline under the APA provisions and stated that it is the view of the Corrections Division and the governor's office concurs that the safeguards built into the APA process for participation and scrutiny, coupled with the fact that the provisions are reviewed by legislative, that the rules are reviewed by legislative council, obviates the need for the final review and approval of the governor. And so, before you, the bill deletes the requirement that their disciplinary rules be approved by the governor.
Is there a motion on the bill?
So moved.
Representative Courtney moves House Bill 2213 be reported with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Hold on.
Lombard.
Aye.
Hill.
Aye.
Courtney.
Yes.
Miller.
Aye.
Lamar.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Rutherford.
Excuse
me. Chairman Meyer.
Aye.
We're going to take a 5-minute recess. We still have a reasonable amount of ground to cover, and there is a Republican caucus at 4 o'clock that I'd like to try to honor. However, this is a rather important work session. So I'd like to start again about 3 o'clock. So we'll be recessed for about 5 minutes.
Not only watch it, I'm recording, but I don't know if it's on.
House Bill 2214.
Probably out of wait for form.
Seems reasonable.
Was passed, due pass is amended to the full committee with conceptual amendments relating to the public records law, which have just been distributed to you. Under existing law, whenever an inmate is transferred from a correctional institution, the superintendent of that institution is required to send the committing court a notice of the transfer that includes the name of the inmate and where the inmate's being transferred to. The superintendent also must keep those records of the transfer on file as public records. House Bill 2214 eliminates the required notice of transfer to the courts and instead provides that the record of transfer will be provided to law enforcement agencies and the courts upon request. The experience of the Corrections Division is that most courts either are not interested in the notice or not aware of the requirement of notice to the courts. This bill, therefore, is intended to dispense with unnecessary paperwork and commitment of staff resources. House Bill 2214 also provides that the Corrections Division will adopt rules governing the release of transfer information to other interested parties. Since sometimes transfers are requested and arranged for protective purposes, the division's concern is the requirements that they be public records open to inspection by all may defeat these purposes. It's the intention, however, of the division to follow the public records law in the release of information to other interested parties. amendment before you is intended to clarify this point. Its effect would be a weighing of whether the public interest in confidentiality outweighs the public interest in disclosure, which is a standard the division presently applies in disclosing its records, which are exempt under the public records law. And I'd refer that is under ORS 192.500 sub 2 B.
Chair, I move the adoption of the amendment to line 15 as distributed to the members, since that was acted on conceptually only in the subcommittee stage. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Adopted. Representative Courtney moves House Bill 2214 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Courtney?
Yes.
Lumler? Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Chairman Meyer?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, will the maker of each motion be the one to sign to carry the bill?
Didn't I say that?
I think you did, yeah.
House Bill 2085.
House Bill 2085 was passed by Subcommittee 1 to the full committee. Do pass as amended. I've passed out a hand-engrossed copy of the version of the bill with amendments. It's adopted by the subcommittee. The bill, as amended, clarifies the authority to require payment or to waive probation supervision fees. It also clarifies the responsibility for collecting these fees as well as the right to retain them. Existing law provides that any person placed on parole, probation, or other release who is supervised by Corrections Division or Community Corrections Program is required to pay a monthly fee to offset the costs of that supervision. The new subsection 2 merely provides that anyone presently or in the future who is not supervised under these programs may be required to pay a fee to offset the cost of their supervision as well. The new subsection 4, which begins at line 10 and continues on to the second page, establishes that whatever entity actually supervises the individual is responsible for collecting the supervision fee, and that same agency retains the fee. If anyone needs further clarification, I can explain how that works in various scenarios under the Community Corrections Act and outside. There is one